an Sapai, das L steht für Gefahr. Viel Spaß mit den Herren gedeckt.
Herrengedeck. Fußballkultur. Mit Musik.
Sunday night, 7 p.m. time for Herrengedeck on Radio Free FM 102.6. On the microphone, Andreas Kulik. When it comes to football, my tonight's guest is a jack of all trades. He is the author of numerous books such as Philosophy Football and England Travels with a Football Nation. He's a part-time research fellow in sport and leisure culture at the University of Brighton. As the co-director of an event management company, he has worked on a lot of sporting events, including several FA Cup finals, 6 Champions League finals, and every England football international since June 1998. He also is co-founder of the self-styled Sporting Outfitters of Intellectual Distinction, also known as Philosophy Football. I'm more than glad to have him on the phone tonight. Welcome to Germany's finest football show, Mark Perryman.
Good evening.
Yeah, hi Mark. You're in England. Where are you actually?
Lewes in East Sussex, about 200 metres from a community-owned football club, Lewes FC, who play in the Ryman Premier League, which is level 7 in the English divisions.
Did they play today?
No, they should have played yesterday, but it rained. They're a non-league side. They're an amateur side, if you like, semi-professional side. So the pitch doesn't have the maintenance that it should at a higher level. So if it rains heavily, unfortunately, the game has to be postponed.
Okay, let's come to yourself. In 1997, you published a book titled Philosophy Football. In Germany, it's available under the title Erster FC Philosophie. How did you get the idea to the book?
Well, it was 3 years on from starting the t-shirts. The website is www.philosophyfootball.com. And we found the words of some of the world's greatest philosophers on the world's greatest game, football. And I met a publisher and at a party, and I said, look, we're doing these t-shirts. He said, I know all about your t-shirts. I bought them. I love them. Albert Camus, Friedrich Nietzsche, Karl Marx, Simone de Beauvoir, Jean-Paul Sartre. What a great idea. I said, look, I've got this idea for a book. Could we use football to explain their work as philosophers? He said, I want to publish that book. And so I wrote it in about 6 months. All I did was I read philosophy non-stop for 6 months. I mean, I try to imagine what kind of footballer Nietzsche would have been, what kind of footballer Jean-Paul Sartre would have been, and then used football to explain their work. So it's a humorous book, but it's based on fact. It's using football to explain philosophy. And then I was absolutely astonished after it was published. It was translated not only into German, but into Dutch, Turkish. There's a Brazilian edition, a South Korean edition, a Japanese edition. All around the world, people seem to like the idea. And I've written and edited numerous books, but none of them have been published into, translated into sort of 11 or 12 languages. There was an Italian edition as well, if I remember correctly.
So it was a kind of success you hadn't really expected.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of, there was that book, Sophie's World, which kind of used children's fairy stories to explain philosophy. So there was a kind of, and there's been books using Winnie the Pooh and Bruce Lee and Muhammad Ali to explain Eastern philosophy. So there's been a sort of kind of, it's quite a trend in publishing in the late 90s of using sort of funny ideas to explain extremely complex ideas. So it kind of fitted into a groove at the time. But also, in the 90s, which I think was a sort of golden era, certainly for the English-speaking world, for some kind of football culture. Football reached so many different dimensions through culture, including literature. So I think that was it fitted into that kind of groove at the time as well.
If I got you right, you really read a lot of those philosophers' books. So did you read each single one of them?
Yeah, I mean, in fact, there was a second book as well. So there was 22 philosophers whose work I had to really understand. I kind of read, what I did was, I was very disciplined, very Germanic, if you like, in terms of my approach. For 3 weeks solid, all I would do would read this philosopher. And then in the fourth week each month, I would turn them in, I would use my knowledge of football to use the football to explain their philosophy. So it kind of worked. I've got a sort of long-term idea to do it the other way round, which is to do a book of footballers and use philosophy to explain the footballers, but I haven't ever got round to that idea yet.
Is there a footballer who is a great philosopher?
Well, it has to be Eric Cantona. You know, he was the footballer who brought to the English game the idea that you could be as interested in Rambo, the philosopher, as Rambo, the film star, you know, the Sylvester Stallone film. Mm. So, and he really sort of challenged people's ideas of what it meant to be a footballer. And what's been interesting is that since the end of his footballing career, he's dabbled with film. He's been very outspoken on issues of Islamophobia. He's been very outspoken on the issues of Palestine. He's worked on films, documentaries about corruption at the highest level of the game in terms of FIFA and the Brazilian World Cup. And so he sort of carried that forward. Other players who would typify that in terms of the English game would be Dennis Bergkamp. But Jurgen Klinsmann as well. Jurgen Klinsmann, when he played that great season for Spurs, he was well known for sort of hanging out as sort of driving a battered old Volkswagen Beetle and hanging out with a lot of sort of off-the-wall left-field comedy stars and going to their shows and just doing his football in a very different way to the one that we were used to, if you like.
Let's stick with Eric for a while. A few weeks ago, it was the 20th anniversary of his Kung Fu Kick on a Crystal Palace supporter. And you wrote an article on this incident, headlined, Je suis Cantona. In which way do you identify with Eric?
Well, I can remember the game. It was in 95. We started the company in 94. Our first shirt was an Albert Camus shirt because Camus was both a Nobel Prize winner for literature, one of the founders of existentialism, and played in goal for Algeria. And we were sort of looking around for a footballer who would represent what we were trying to do, which was to put philosophical ideas on the front of a shirt and name and number on the back. And Cantona was the obvious candidate, and we'd produced a shirt in early February, if I remember correctly, maybe January actually. And then that week, this incident took place. Some fans have challenged me to say it wasn't live on TV. I do seem to remember it being live on TV, but it was absolutely everywhere. And he didn't simply assault a supporter. A supporter came down 11 rows back, down in the front row, a pile of racist, xenophobic abuse, which was attacking Cantona because he was French. And Cantona responded in a very dramatic fashion. I don't think anybody would defend somebody kicking out as a supporter, but he took a stand. And football's not very good at taking a stand. Certainly back in those days, he's not very good at taking a very firm stand. He took sides. Sport is about taking sides sometimes. It's not sport for all. It's not, for my mind, you know, football shouldn't be open to racists and xenophobes and the violent. And he took a stand, and he was penalised very heavily for it. He was found guilty in a court of law. He was suspended for 6 months, which was unknown. But many fans stood by him and said, look, we want Cantona in the game. We don't want racist hooligans in the game. And so we stood by him. And 20 years later, with our tongues in our cheek, instead of Je suis Charlie Hebdo, we produced a Je suis Cantona t-shirt. And on the sleeve, it said clearly, United against racism. I'm not a Manchester United fan. But you didn't need to be a United fan in order to stand with Cantona against racism that night and ever since.
at least in Germany, I think, in England as well, racism and homophobia are still part of the game, whether we like it or not. It's still in the stadium. What do you think is the best way for a player to deal with that?
Well, I think, first of all, what we need to remember is that racism and homophobia, xenophobia, Islamophobia, and so on, exist in society. So why should football be any different? Well, the key reason why football should be different is because, unlike the sort of 70s and 80s, our teams are so multicultural, and it absolutely defies common sense to racially abuse players on the opposite side when you've got black and brown players on your own side. And I think that's what's fundamentally challenged racism within football. But this is what I would describe as a territorial anti-racism. It's nothing really to do with embracing multiculturalism. It's about thinking, well, I'm not going to give those players a hard time because of the colour of their skin, because it might offend some of our players. So it doesn't really affect attitudes. And I think it's a societal problem. It's not something that football can do on its own, but it needs to wise up to the fact. But if it's going to take a stand against racism, there's no point issuing fines. It's about banning, it's about docking points, it's about games being forced to play behind closed doors. But at the same time, football needs to work with social forces in order to change people's attitudes. And I think what sport does in general, football in particular, because it's such a big sport, is it opens a window of opportunity for a conversation. But people would say, well, you know, yeah, well, I'm not particularly in favour of Islam, for instance, but I've noticed loads of our players are Islamic. So what's going on there? You know, particularly if they're French North Africans, they're going to be, likelihood is they're going to be Islamic. So it opens up an opportunity for people to be more engaged, if you like, with multiculturalism. But it won't solve it. Football can't do that on its own. So that's what we need. We need activity inside and outside of a stadium. So there's not, I think this is broadly true in Germany, certainly true in England, is there's not a popular movement against racism. You know, it's very much for the sort of hardcore activists, and that's where football and sport can play a key role, because it opens up a conversation. You have huge debates about national identity, I'm thinking outside of football, but in terms of London 2012, where our medals are being won over and over again by black and brown athletes. Again, it opens up a conversation when an England team is so obviously black and white. You know, our greatest ever moment, I don't want to upset your listeners, was of course 31st of July 1966, when we rather unfairly beat Germany 4-2 after extra time. We could talk about the fairness of those goals in a moment, but that was an all-white England team. It was an all-white German team. It's inconceivable that a team selected for the Euro 2016 qualifiers in a few weeks' time, either an English team or a German team, would be all-white. And that's not because either of our managers are particularly politically correct. It's because they're drawing on the best players in their league, and those leagues draw on increasingly multicultural societies. So that reflects a change, and that enables a conversation to take place, but it doesn't actually enable deep-seated attitudes to change a lot.
Is the situation which continental and other foreign players face today in the Premier League different from the one when Cantona was still playing?
Yeah, I mean, I think football, to about 95, you know, you've got to remember only 10 years previously, all English club sides had been banned from European competition. Liverpool had been banned indefinitely from European club competition because of the outrage at the Hazel European Cup final in 85. It took 5 years until English club sides were allowed back into European competition. I think it was another year before Liverpool were allowed back in. So you were still at, you know, in terms of aftermath of that hooliganism, which scarred the game in the 1980s. I teach a course at the University of Brighton on football culture and community, and I record those games in the 80s where teams were forced to play games behind closed doors, where games were stopped, where fans lost their lives, where hundreds were arrested at those games. Now, we've not seen episodes of that sort in a long time in English football, but in 95 it was still a very recent memory.
Mark, we'll take a short break and then we'll be back talking about traveling with the England national team and about club football.
I hope we can talk about the 1st of September 2001, one of my most favorite trips.
We will, I promise. But first of all, we will listen to some music you brought with you, and that's New Order featuring John Barnes, World in Motion, and then we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Herrengedeck Fußballkultur with music on 102.6 on Sunday evening. On the phone still I've got author, research fellow, co-founder and coordinator and so much more, Mark Perryman. Mark, we stopped our interview at the 1st of September 2001. Why is it a magic date?
Well, it was, of course, the game in Munich. England had been defeated by Germany almost a year previously, the last game at Wembley, and Germany humiliated us with, I think it was only a 1-0 defeat, but England were absolutely nowhere. The manager, Kevin Keegan, of course, a Hamburg legend, resigned live on TV. He said, look, incredibly honest guy, actually, he said, look, I've just realised I'm not up to the job. The team looked in quite a state. They brought in a foreign manager for the first time ever, Sven-Göran Eriksson. Had done okay under Eriksson. I remember going to Athens, seeing England win away in Athens. And then we're facing the leaders in the group in September 2001, almost 1 year on from that humiliating defeat at Wembley, at Wembley's last game. And we win 5-1. It's just extraordinary. It was an extraordinary night. Of course, what it proved to be, looking back, 11, 12 years on, it was one of the great fall storms in terms of my years following England, because we thought, okay, we've beaten Germany 5-1 away. I think it's Germany's ever biggest ever home defeat in a competitive match. We thought we're on our way, and of course we come to World Cup 2002. We qualify as group we've topped the qualifying group. Germany have had to go to a qualifier, a knockout against Ukraine. We go to the World Cup. England have an okay World Cup. We get to the quarterfinals. We go out to Brazil, having been 1-0 up. We go out to the eventual winners. Germany make it to the final, and the rest is history. Germany's had a much more successful 11 or 12 years since 2001 than England has. So a fantastic night to be at, but a great fall storm.
You wrote a book about your travels with England. It's called England's Travels with a Football Nation. For how long have you been traveling with the national team?
Well, I'm a new parent now. I've kind of given up in the last year or so. But from 96 through to 2008, I went to virtually every away game, with every home game, went to all the tournaments, and had some just incredible experience for just a little bit over 10 years. And you ended up, particularly when we went to South Africa in 2010, I can remember coming home, people said, God, you must have had an appalling trip. You know, the football was pretty awful. We humiliated him in the 16 game by Germany 4-1. I said, well, no. The football just takes up a small portion of it. We had a fantastic 4 weeks in South Africa. And we wouldn't go so far as to say it was those intermissions of the football that spoiled the trip. But it became increasingly so that actually it was the trip that you enjoyed. And the football was the reason you were going to places like Bulgaria or Albania or Kazakhstan, Azerbaisan. You know, the great respect to Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan and Albania. You wouldn't probably choose to go there on a holiday.
Not
but
really.
You did go there for a football match, and it made it so special. And at the beginning, England had an incredibly negative reputation. You know, you arrived and every bar was shut, every hotel had vacancies full signs up, the police were on the streets with snarling dogs, and their lot of hooligans were looking for our lot of hooligans, and gradually that changed. I'm very proud to say that I played a small but part in that change. And I can remember We played a game when Wembley had been opened with Germany, a friendly, and we organised to play a friendly match against the team made up of actors from your great film The Miracle of Berne. And of course the referee in the 54 Cup World Cup final was an English referee, and we had the actor, the German actor, who played the English referee in the 54 World Cup final, Miracle of Berne, was our referee. And the I can't remember the name of the very famous film director, but he turned up as well. And it was just part of that shift. But what we have in common is the love of football. And the punchline is that in the fans match it went to penalties and we won. It was the first time ever that an English representative team had beaten Germany on penalties, and we managed it that night. I think it was in 2007. It was a great night.
During the times of the travels, you helped found the London England fans group. What kind of group is this?
It's a fans group. It's a fans-led group. Came together really because we realised that there's so many things you don't have in common as an England fan. You support different teams, you have different jobs, you come from different parts of the country, you have different attitudes in politics, if any attitude at all. But one thing you have in common is your away games take place abroad. And invariably outside of Europe as well as in Europe. And so actually it was travel that united. And if you enjoy the travelling, you're much less likely to cause trouble or offence when you go abroad, because it defies common sense, you know, to go into the first bar you find, you start abusing the bar staff. Well, you're not going to be made very welcome in that bar or the next bar or the one after. The same would apply to hotels and restaurants and so on. So, you know, if you enjoy the travel, you know, you're bought into the fact that you're kind of an ambassador. But actually internationalism is a big part of your football culture. So we united really around travel, and we developed a good relationship with the media, good relationship with the Football Association. And in 2003, when England played away in South Africa, we thought, well, we're going away to South Africa, we've got to do something. We organised this trip to the townships. We met fellow fans in the townships. We visited schools. We did little coaching sessions. And the fans really responded positively, and we've done something like that on almost every trip ever since that. And it's something very special now about following England that we do what we call these fan-friendly activities, not because we're social workers or something, but because it's part of a trip, you know, it's an enjoyable part of a trip.
So it's like football's not only the match, but it's an experience.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think I'll come to what I'd really like to talk about on the German radio show is our admiration for the German model. I thought a fantastic banner at Bayern Munich last weekend, which is this is not the Premiership. And what that summed up was the fact that despite, I know there's increasing commercialisation of the German game, but none of your clubs are foreign owned. All of your clubs are 51% owned by the fans.
Most of them,
at a Bundesliga game. You can drink a pint of beer at a Bundesliga game.
Yeah.
The core of a national team play in your league, you know, with less foreign players than we have. It's a competitive league, and the ticket prices are something like 10% the price of our tickets. And when I rehearse this to students, of course, my punchline is, and of course, German football is shit. And they will laugh. Well, isn't this the team that's just won the World Cup? Isn't this the country that's produced a couple of years ago both Champions League finalists? And obviously, I'm being ironic. And the other criticism that used to be of the Bundesliga is that the stadiums weren't up to scratch. But of course, they will modernise the 2006 World Cup, and the stadiums are at least of a standard that we have in England, if not better. And the atmosphere is fantastic at Bundesliga games. And it's an incredible statistic that was unearthed recently, that every Borussia Dortmund home game, there's something like 1,000 people travel over from England. And what was carried by the BBC on one of their websites was that those fans have worked out it was cheaper, including the travel and staying in a, you know, a cheap bed and breakfast hotel. It was a cheaper way to watch football than to go to a Premiership game in London. So there's huge admiration for the German model, and it's something that we can throw back at the Premier League, and thank goodness that we can. Is if the Germans can run football like that, why can't we? And I think that's a very interesting, probably not got enough time tonight, but I think it's a very interesting question for an Anglo-German conversation. If the Bundesliga can be organized in that way. Why can't the Premier League?
I'll keep that question in mind and I'll try to get you on the show.
I'd love to talk about that again. I've got my own theory. I'll give it to you for the it's a sort of 5-minute theory. Is that English society is fundamentally neoliberal. Doesn't matter what government is in power. English society is fundamentally neoliberal in values. German society, doesn't matter which government is in power, German values are fundamentally social democratic. And that means that certain things can't be done in the way that football is organised like a business. And that would be my theory. Maybe your listeners might phone in or email in or tweet, and we can have a debate about that in a couple of weeks' time.
Would be lovely. I'll keep that in mind and I'll contact you. I know you've got to go on very soon because you're a very busy man. Just to end the conversation, can you tell me what's your favourite club? Who do you support? And how much are the ticket prices?
Yeah, I grew up as a Crystal Palace fan. I grew up in North Surrey, south of London, and they were the nearest league team. So my dad used to take me occasionally to Crystal Palace matches. I've never claimed to be sort of a born and bred football fan. My dad was more of a rugby player. I was more of an athlete, a runner in my youth. I went to university. A fanzine called When Saturday Comes started coming out, and it really reignited my love of football from adolescence, if you like. Moved to London. After working there for 3 or 4 years, got a decent job. I was living in Tottenham, and in 91 they won the FA Cup. And I got a decent job. I cycled down to the club. I lived about a mile from the ground. I bought a season ticket there and then. I had a season ticket for about 20 years. The last couple of years, I realised I just detested everything about the Premier League. My position is what I call against modern football. I love football. I can't stand what it's become. But I was going to Tottenham because I enjoyed the football, the standard of football, whether it was Tottenham or whichever team they were playing, I was enjoying. But I lost the identification with the club. A couple of years ago, moved to Lewes in East Sussex. Lewes has a community-owned club. It's a non-league club. It's effectively Division 7. It's three steps below the professional game, and it's community owned, and we attract crowds of 300 or 400. I know in level 7 in Germany you wouldn't attract crowds of anything kind of near that kind of number, and it again reconnected me with the game because it doesn't have all the commercialism about it. The standard isn't as good, whether it's for facilities or what's going on the pitch, but I just love the fact that it's just a football club. It doesn't try to pretend to be something that it isn't, and it's very much connected to the local community, and it's a minority movement amongst football fans, but there is definitely a small but significant shift of fans saying we're not going to tolerate for a premiership anymore. We're going to go our own way. We want to get back to what football used to be like. And like I said, I don't want to blow that all out of all proportion, but it's a small but significant shift amongst some fans to say we're going to watch our football in a different way.
I hope this way will be the one to success. And I thank you that you had the time for being here on the show tonight. And it would be lovely talking to you again, maybe another time.
Right.
And my best wishes to Louise. Have a nice evening, Mark.
Okay, cheers then. Bye.
Cheers, bye.
The king is red, long live the king. To hear Old Trafford's voices singing.
Free FM.
Jahren. Weiter geht's hier im Herrengedeck mit dem gerade angesprochenen Buch Philosophy Football meines heutigen Gastes Mark Perryman, der ein sehr vielbeschäftigter Mann ist und heute Abend sich wenigstens eine halbe Stunde freischaufeln konnte, ehe er anderen Verpflichtungen in England wieder nachgehen muss. Ja, das Buch Philosophy Football auf Deutsch, 1. FC Philosophie, Flachdenken, Hochgewinnen, erschienen im Ullstein Verlag 1998. Das hat eine Mannschaftsaufstellung auf den Seiten 12 und 13 und ich möchte euch nicht entlassen aus dem heutigen Abend, ohne euch diese vorgetragen zu haben, dass ihr mal wisst, welche Philosophen es denn in die Mannschaft von Mark Perryman geschafft haben. Nummer 1, Albert Camus, 1913 bis 1960 seine Lebensdaten. Existenzialist und Nobelpreisträger, Autor unter anderem von Der Fall und Der Fremde. Camus wurde in Algerien geboren und arbeitete als Journalist. Kontakte mit der französischen Resistance während des Zweiten Weltkrieges hatte er. Camus wurde in den 50ern zu einem der wichtigsten Literaten und Denker der Nachkriegszeit. Nummer 2, Simone de Beauvoir, 1908 bis 1986, die Mutter des Feminismus, Autorin von Romanen, ihrer Autobiografie und das andere Geschlecht. Durch ihre Arbeit wurde insbesondere das Bewusstsein dafür geschärft, wie Männer über sich selbst als Subjekte und Frauen als Objekte schreiben und denken. Nummer 3, Jean Baudrillard, Jahrgang 1929, Pionier des Postmodernismus. Ein provokanter Denker, der sich besonders mit den Medien beschäftigt und berühmt wurde durch den Ausspruch, der Golfkrieg hat nie stattgefunden. Seine Welt ist eine Welt der Simulationen der Begriffe und Konzepte, wie Wahrheit oder Gesellschaft nicht mehr existieren. Mit der Rückennummer 4, William Shakespeare, 1564 bis 1616, Englands wichtigster Dramatiker, Autor zahlreicher Tragödien, Komödien und historischer Schauspiele, aber auch als Dichter. Nicht schlecht. Heutzutage eher bekannt als Drehbuchautor von Kenneth Branagh. Nummer 5, Friedrich Nietzsche, 1844 bis 1900, deutscher Philosoph, den einige für gefährlich halten, da er immer wieder auf die Unterschiede zwischen Gut und Böse hinwies. Nietzsche war keiner, der eine Kontroverse aus dem Weg ging und entsprechend machte er sich auch für eine herausgehobene Stellung einer einzelnen Person im politischen Entscheidungsprozess stark. Nummer 6, Ludwig Wittgenstein, 1889 bis 1951, Österreicher, der ein wenig durch die Welt reiste, bevor er sich in Großbritannien niederließ, Zeitgenosse von Bertrand Russell, der sich aber mit ihm überwarf, als Wittgenstein sich immer mehr der Sprachanalyse als zentralem Feld seiner philosophischen Arbeit zuwandte. Ja, und an der Stelle hören wir ein bisschen Musik zum Thema Wittgenstein, nämlich Tillmann Rosmi, Wittgenstein sagt, und dann wird die Mannschaftsaufstellung komplettiert.
Sentence is more important. Why didn't you thank us on your records?
Yeah.
You thought we were your inspiration.
We were your
leader.
Your healer, breeder, healer, dealer, tailor.
Your guru.
Yeah.
So on the next records we want to see our names. Thanks to Toilet Light and Dr. Martens and Patrick De Brewer and Oscar Wilde.
Of course we want.
If you don't do that, we won't be your inspiration anymore.
Schmidt, Message from Oscar Wilde and Patrick the Brewer. Warum? Weil Oscar Wilde der Spieler ist, der im 1. FC Philosophie die Rückennummer 7 trägt. Geboren 1854, verstorben 1900, war er Dandy, Autor und der Mann, über den man spricht. Er wurde vom britischen Establishment für seinen exotischen Lebensstil an den Pranger gestellt und auch ins Gefängnis gebracht. Nummer 8, Sun Tzu, ca. 500 vor Christus hat er gelebt, chinesischer General und Militärstratege, sein Büchlein Die Kunst des Krieges wird heutzutage insbesondere von leitenden Angestellten kleinerer Werbeagenturen und mittleren Managern größerer Firmen gekauft, die durch die Lektüre versuchen, Sinn in ihre Beschäftigung zu bringen. Umberto Eco. Er trägt die Nummer 9, geboren 1932, Universitätsprofessor und Bestsellerautor. Sein Roman »Der Name der Rose«, eine mittelalterliche Detektivgeschichte, wurde auf der ganzen Welt ein großer Erfolg. Als Akademiker beschäftigt er sich in erster Linie mit der Semiotik der Sprache der Zeichen. Nummer 10, Antonio Gramsci, 1891 bis 1937, Heldenfigur der italienischen Marxisten, der durch Mussolinis Faschisten einen frühen Tod starb. Seine Gefängnistagebücher wurden postum veröffentlicht und zur Pflichtlektüre jedes aufrechten Klassenkämpfers, da sich Gramsci insbesondere mit den Machtstrukturen politischer Systeme auseinandersetzte. Und schließlich in der Startformation die Nummer 11, Bob Marley, von 1945 bis 81 gelebt, Musiker und Rastafari, nicht der Gründer, aber sicherlich der Pate des modernen Reggae, war ständig auf Tournee und fand doch immer wieder Zeit, sich für sein Heimatland Jamaika politisch zu engagieren. Get up, stand up. Das war eine Stunde Fußball und Philosophie mit Mark Perryman im Herrengedeck am Sonntagabend. Danke nochmal nach East Sussex an Mark Perryman für das Gespräch. Die Sendung findet ihr bald auch im Archiv unter www.freefm.de/programm/herrengedeck oder auf herrengedeck.blogspot.de. Wir hören uns wieder in 2 Wochen. Wie es dann weitergeht, könnt ihr auch bei Facebook lesen. Wir werden uns auf jeden Fall mit den kleinen Clubs in den großen Europapokalnächten beschäftigen und dazu auch einen adäquaten Gast am Start haben. Das wird der Terence Treber aus Mannheim sein. Ich freue mich schon ganz besonders darauf, da doch einige Gänsehautspiele dabei sind. Und jetzt, nachdem wir gerade das Line-Up von Mark Perryman gehört haben, hören wir jetzt noch die Aufstellung von Monty Python zum Thema International Philosophy. Und zum Abschluss kommen dann noch A Voice Like Rhetoric, Please Don't Call Me a Mindless Philosophy. Bis in 14 Tagen. Ade.
Good afternoon and welcome to a packed Olympic Stadium München for the second leg of this exciting final. And here come the Germans now, led by their skipper, Nobby Hagel. They must surely start favorites this afternoon. They've certainly attracted the most attention from the press with their team problems. And let's now see their lineup. The Germans playing 4-2-4, Leibniz in goal, back four, Kant, Hegel, Schopenhauer and Schelling, front runners Schlegel, Wittgenstein, Nietzsche and Heidegger, and the midfield duo of Beckenbauer and Jaspers. Beckenbauer obviously a bit of a surprise there.
Das Größte, was es gibt in Deutschland mit Andreas Kulig.
Andreas Kulig.
Andreas Kulig. Andreas Kulig.
Mit Andreas Kulig.
Herrengedeck auf Radio Free FM.